I was slightly tempted this morning to begin by playing that cover hit from the Byrds back in 1965. Do you know the one? Turn, turn, turn. To everything, turn. Better not sing. It's basically Ecclesiastes chapter 3. To everything, there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. People love this chapter, don't they? These are famous words, and they love this chapter not just because of an American folk rock band. People love it because they want to know that there's a time for everything. They want to know that life in the universe has some order to it, that whatever it is we're going through, you know, it's not spiraling out of control. That's how life feels sometimes. And so we want to know that somehow, through all the ups and downs and through all the chaos of life, we want to know that somehow there is an orderly, purposeful rhythm to life. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to uproot. The trouble is that these verses are actually bittersweet. What do I mean by that? Well, just look at his concluding remark in verse 9. It's not the most comforting remark that he begins with in verse 9, is it? I mean, after all the stuff he says about time, he then concludes by saying, what then? You know, what does the worker gain from his toil? The implied answer is nothing. Because, you know, whatever you're doing, whatever you're giving yourself to in these days, the time will come when the very opposite will be done. And what we have here is a list, these first eight verses, we have a list of 14 pairs of opposites. Total opposites. And can there be anything more frustrating than busting your gut trying to do one thing when before long all your work will be undone by the very opposite? Yeah, what's to gain from that? In a way, it's utterly futile and absurd to labor at something knowing that the very opposite will soon take place. So, verse 2, you might throw a party to celebrate a new birth. There's a time to be born. But, of course, the life you welcome into the world will, sadly and tragically, one day die. And he says the same later on in verse 19. As animals die, verse 19, so do human beings. From dust we all came, to dust we all return, verse 20. A time to be born, and a time to die. Tears of joy replaced by tears of grief, replaced by tears of joy, replaced by tears of grief, and so on. This, and then the opposite. This, and then the opposite. And in your short life, and in my short life, we give ourselves to plant, verse 2, and then before long we have to uproot. A time to plant, a time to uproot. And there's, you know, you begin to feel, as you go through Ecclesiastes, the terrible frustration of life, the burden of life, where you give yourself to this, but what does it come to? You end up doing the opposite. And there's such frustration. I remember getting, we have a house in Portadown, I remember getting grass sown in the garden. I really wanted the grass to grow. And then what? I wish the grass would stop growing. Or what about this for a strange world? There's a time to kill, verse 3, right? So the shepherd will take his knife to the sheep. Maybe it's time for a meal or it's time for a sacrifice. There's a time to kill. But think about this. The sheep he kills will be the one that he earlier looked after. You know, he maybe nursed it back to health at one stage. There's a time to heal. And now he kills it. At one level, it's crazy. Or again, in verse 3, there's a time to tear down. You know, a bulldozer will take just a few minutes, maybe, to raise a house to the ground. And yet, what a strange world we live in, because the builder who tears down that house may have spent weeks putting up that same house with such care and precision. There's a time to build. This is life, isn't it? At one level, it's absurd. There's no permanence to anything. What does the worker gain from his toil? It's the same question that is raised right at the beginning in chapter 1, verse 3, repeated again in chapter 2, verse 11, repeated again in chapter 2, verse 22. What do we gain from all our labor and work? There's no permanence to anything. Sometimes life will make you cry, verse 4. Sometimes it will make you laugh. Sometimes you will mourn. Sometimes you will dance. One thing replaced by the other, replaced by the other, and then the other. You know, it's a funny old world. I remember, I've told you about my dog. Back in the day, I remember training my dog. Give me your paw. Give me your paw. Give me your paw. Good dog. Well done. And then what? Would you ever stop begging? Stop it. Put your paw down, you know, after I'd trained it to do the very thing that I then wanted to stop it doing. You know, this is some of the stuff of life. It's just, the crazy things that we give ourselves to, and then what? A time to scatter stones, verse 5. You think of all the precious stones that King Solomon gathered. You read about it in 1 Kings chapter 10. He gathered all these precious stones. There's a time to gather. And it was fun for a while. But of course, what he labored so hard to gather is quickly scattered. And there's a time to embrace and a time to refrain, verse 5. That may also allude to the embracing of wealth that can't go on forever. There's a time to search, verse 6. But bear in mind that whatever wealth you find, you can't keep it very long. Someday you're going to have to give it up. There's a time to give up. A time to keep. Yes, you might collect all sorts of things. Any collectors among us? You might collect all sorts of things. You might be a hoarder. But someday all the stuff you've so diligently and carefully collected, you're going to throw away. That time inevitably comes. Even relationships are subject to the same lack of permanence. You know, they're torn at times and need to be mended, verse 7. It's funny though, isn't it? You know, we teach our kids to be friendly to others, but it could be that we also have to say, that person is bad news. I know I told you to be a good friend, but trust me, walk away. There's a time to tear. It can be a confusing world. And if only we had the wisdom to know when to be silent and when to speak, verse 7. There's a time for both. There's a time to love and a time to hate, verse 8. A time for war and a time for peace. These words are not saying how life should be. They're just telling us how life is. And who can make sense of it? You know, good friends part in bitter conflict while peace-loving nations prepare for war. I've seen the burden God has laid on man, verse 10. One of the commentators calls it the tyranny of time. You know, you maybe look forward to the weekend. Some people live for the weekend. But before we know it, it's Monday morning all over again. Nothing lasts. Who can make sense of it? I mean, apart from faith in God, apart from trusting that everything is in God's hands, and that he will judge, and that he will put everything right in the end. If we don't turn to God, then our short lives really are just a meaningless and absurd list of opposites. For some people, the frustration of life is proof enough that there is no God. And maybe that's you this morning, or maybe your friends and family and colleagues, and they just, you know, their experience of life tells them, there is no God. They don't actually have proof of that, but they take it on faith. They choose to believe that. They choose to believe that there's no God to be reckoned with, no judgment, and no eternity. But lest you're tempted to go down that road, please note that the teacher in this book comes to the very opposite conclusion in light of all his studies. I mean, he has studied all of life. He has investigated everything that takes place under the sun. And while he recognizes that man cannot work God out, you know, I mean, without revelation, human beings simply cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end, verse 11. Nevertheless, he absolutely believes in God and trusts in God. Why? Why does he do it? Well, there's a very good reason for it in verse 11. According to verse 11, do you see this? According to verse 11, God has set eternity in the hearts of men. There's something undeniable about you and me. You may have a very strong faith, for all I know, that there is no God. That may be your faith, that there is no God. But the fact is that everyone on the planet longs for eternity. God has set eternity in the hearts of men. In a world where nothing lasts, we long for eternity. We need to reflect on that for a moment, because C.S. Lewis, some of you may have read C.S. Lewis, you know, Narnia Chronicles and many other books. C.S. Lewis argued that our desires tell us something fundamental about our existence. Consider this, he said. If human beings were a species that did not normally eat and were not designed to eat, would we feel hungry? Of course not. In other words, our longing for something is an indication of reality. If a man is hungry, that doesn't prove that he will get anything to eat, but it does at least prove that there is such a thing as food, surely. And you and I long, we long for a perfected and a transformed world where things last. A world in which we're completely fulfilled, completely satisfied. We long to be known, we long to be loved, we long to be made complete by God. And the sheer fact of our longing, the sheer fact of our longing points to the greater fact that God exists, that we were made to know him, that we were made to be with him in a perfect world forever. We may do all the wrong things in trying to get there. We may abuse and spoil and pervert the knowledge of God for our own selfish gain, but we cannot deny that we do not feel at home and at peace in this world which has turned its back on God. You know, we just, things are not right, and we yearn for things to be right, and we yearn to know God and to be with God. Our souls are restless until they find their rest in God, and he is the ultimate reality to which all our longing points. Again, C.S. Lewis says this. He said, "Do fish complain of the sea for being wet? No, because they're fully at home in the sea. But if they did complain, that would itself be a strong indication that they had not always been or would always be purely aquatic creatures." You know, you get the point? Why do we long for wholeness and satisfaction and fulfillment if we were not made for it? That doesn't make any sense. If there is no such thing as justice and righteousness and wholeness of life, then why would we long for it? I mean, if we were made for this broken and disintegrated world which has turned its back on God, then why are we not happy in it? If we really do live in a material world in which there is no God and no ultimate meaning, then how come we feel that it is so ugly? If we are just products of a materialistic universe, just a bunch of meaningless atoms bumping into each other, then there can't even be categories of ugliness and beauty, right and wrong, for there's just matter. And yet we all know the difference between right and wrong, don't we? We know the reality of good and evil. We know the reality of beauty and ugliness. And we instinctively know that we were made for one over the other. God has set eternity in our hearts. One more line from Lewis. He says, "Notice how we are perpetually surprised at time. How time flies." Do you ever say that? How time flies. Fancy John being all grown up and married. I can hardly believe it. Why on earth are we surprised by time, Lewis says, unless, indeed, there is something in us which is not temporal. God has set eternity in the hearts of men. If the human heart longs for the eternal, unconditional, and redeeming love of God, then maybe it's time that we opened our eyes to see it. And it's only then that we can truly echo the first part of verse 11, that God has made everything beautiful in its time. There is order. There is rhythm. There is a purposeful time to everything. Every day we see glimpses of eternity all around us every day, reminders that God will one day make everything new. I mean, how could we enjoy the sun rising every morning if it didn't set every evening? How could we enjoy the rest of a good night's sleep if we didn't get up each day and do a hard day's work? And so the teacher enjoys life. He enjoys life, verses 12 to 13, again in verse 22. He enjoys life. And these verses are therefore sweet to the eyes of faith, because we know that everything is in the hand of God. Everything is in God's hands. Look at verse 14. I know that everything God does will endure forever. You know, I don't need to understand it all right now. I don't need to understand everything, but, you know, to know and trust that God is on the throne and that his purposes will not fail. The teacher says nothing can be added to what God does, verse 14, and nothing taken from it. Make no mistake, nothing happens except through him and by his will. God does it so that men, human beings, will revere him, verse 14. And that's what this is all about. Do we fear the Lord? You know, all the frustration in the world is ultimately given to us so that we will turn to the only God who is eternal and who alone can give us life in all its fullness. George Bernanos, the French author, and he was a soldier as well in World War I, he said this. He said, in order to be prepared to hope in what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that deceives. Let me say that again. In order to be prepared to hope in what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that deceives. You see, whatever frustration we face in life, we know in verse 15 that there are some things that are fixed. Forget about all the things that pass away. Some things are fixed. Verse 15, God will call the past to account. So when the worker does not profit from anything he labors at under the sun, he can nevertheless rest assured that God will reward what is good and punish what is evil. When there is wickedness in the place of justice, verse 16, we can take heart because God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, verse 17. History's going somewhere. And of course, we know much more about that since the coming of Jesus Christ and his apostles. History is going somewhere. You know, the only fixed realities in this life are death and judgment. And that's actually a comfort to believers in the Lord Jesus. The Lord Jesus is the Lord and Judge of all. And think about him for a moment. He entered our times. The eternal Son of God entered this broken world as we celebrate at Christmas. He walked in our shoes. He lived life with all of its joys and sorrows. He was able to sympathize with us in our weaknesses. And then he went to the cross. So that when he comes back someday soon in judgment, as he will, your penalty and mine would already be paid in full. Hands that flung stars into space to cruel nails surrendered. So that we could receive God's forgiveness full and free and get to live with him in his eternal kingdom. A new creation where there's not going to be any more death or mourning or crying or pain, no more injustice, no more frustration of any kind. This is the world that you were made for, and it's the world that is only found in Jesus Christ. It is his eternal kingdom that we need to be a part of today. And the question is, do we know him? Do we trust in him alone? We must not put that off. There is a time. There is a time to bow the knee and to receive what the Lord Jesus Christ alone can give. There is a time, and that time is now.